And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in a clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host. I have some good news and I have some bad news. Well, I have some bad news, but it's actually some great news. And the bad news is this is not going to be a live show tonight. However, the great news is I have Charlie Foltz and Jim Wiener from the Allagash incident in Maine, a very important case. And I believe this is a very important interview I did with them last year. I did this at a conference, and there was a lot of background noise, so I always wanted to re-record with them. But now that the show is live, they're not going to be able to do that. So I edited the version of recording with them. I do apologize for the background noise, but for the most part, it's a great interview, and you're really going to enjoy it. So there's no astronomy bit this week. This is just going to go right into the interview with Charlie Foltz and Jim Wiener. All right, I'm with Jim and Chuck of the Allagash incident. Thank you so much for joining us. I've been waiting to talk to you guys.
Well, thanks for having us, Martin. It's really a pleasure to be here.
Yeah. Yes, thank you.
So we're here in Maine, and this happened north of here. What is it, 3-4 hours north of here? It's pretty far.
North Maine, above Baxter State Park, north of Mount Katahdin.
Yeah.
And goes right up to the Canadian border.
Right.
So
you're...
I don't know how far away we are from there from here, but when we left Boston, it was...
It was like a full 10 hours drive from Boston.
It was over a nine-hour drive from Boston. Yeah. So.
You can't get there from here, as they say in Maine, right?
Well, you can, but it's not easy.
Yeah.
It's easier to fly.
Yeah. So the thing that I think is the most intriguing about your story is that you really kind of forgot about it for like 10 years or so or something like that. Can first of all, for the person who's never heard about the Allagash incident, does one of you want to explain exactly what happened?
Well, what happened was Charlie and I and my twin brother Jack and another friend of ours from Mass College of Art went up to the first. We spent a weekend on Mount Katahdin climbing around, and then we flew into the Allagash waterway system on a bush plane. And we wanted to spend a couple of weeks canoeing and camping up on the Allagash. It's a dual lake and river system. I think it's about 60 miles of lakes and then another 60 miles of river.
Now, do you have to port? What do they call it when you
portage?
Portage? Do you have to?
Yes.
Yeah. Carry the canoes for a while. And
There are some. Yeah.
Longest portage was a quarter of a mile. That was from Chamberlain into Eagle Lake.
Right.
There were a couple other shorter.
Yeah,
around
and there's another.
The waterfalls.
There's a waterfall you have to portage around, and then there's another stretch of rapids called Chase Rapids, which is about 2.5 miles in length, which you don't have to. They're Class 4, and people run them all the time. Charlie and the other guy that was with us ran them. But if you want, you can portage around those two. So those really only those three areas.
But the bottom line is, it's a very remote area.
Oh,
extremely.
It's very remote.
And
it's
you
like
see
going
moose
back
and bear
in time,
and...
Martin.
Oh yeah, we were going down the Allagash River section, and we were about 15-20 foot from a bull moose. And it was just around the start of rutting season, so. We drifted by quietly without making any noise.
Yeah.
You see a lot of blue heron up there. We did.
Yeah. Eagles.
Eagles, loons, a lot of loons.
A lot of loons, yeah.
So it's
really beautiful, too.
It's very, it's like going back a million years in time. It's
That's
amazing.
Right, yeah. Or like Alaska, almost. So what was the first, you had two sightings, and the first one wasn't so spectacular.
No, it wasn't. We were, the second day in, we were on Chamberlain Lake, and we had just pulled into a campsite, and there was probably 10 or 12 other people at that campsite. It was a fairly large campsite, so there were other people there, and we got in right at dusk, so we were latecomers. And there was a couple gentlemen standing on the beach of the lake who were looking for their sons, were out on the lake in a canoe. And they were a little concerned about it because when it gets dark, you really can't see the shorelines anymore. So they were worried about these kids being caught out on the lake at night. So they were, we were kind of, everybody was standing on the beach, kind of scanning the lake, seeing if we could see any movement out there. And one of these guys suddenly said, "Oh, what's that funny light over on the other side of the lake?" And it was a fair distance away. I mean, I would say it was a few miles at least away from us. And you could see this light moving over the treetops from, I think it was going from right to left, from our right to our left.
Which from meant south to north.
We'd be going from south to the north. And I just happened to have my binoculars with me, so I grabbed my binoculars and focused in. And once I got focused in, I realized that it wasn't a star. It was definitely some type of a craft of some sort that was moving just on the other side of the lake. And I, the other thing I noticed was that it had this really odd quality to the light. I couldn't really put my finger on it, but it was almost like a velvety, yellowish quality to it. And I remember thinking, well, that's odd. And then while I was looking at it, I had been observing it for about 30 seconds. And then all of a sudden, the light just blinked out. It kind of, it didn't really blink out. It went from the outside in, like a
Did you see that at the same time, Chuck?
I saw it disappear. I saw it slightly differently, but maybe that's just.
Well, I mean, he didn't have the binoculars.
Yeah.
I've heard that
you're talking about this, I've heard other people talk about the very same situation where all of a sudden it just goes right down to a point and disappears.
Yep. Yeah. It's what do they call that? Like an iris.
Right.
That,
yep.
you know, closes in on itself. That's, yep. And I thought, wow. That's,
winking out.
That was really odd. But, you know, that's all I thought. I mean, a second later, we were back to setting up camp. It was just,
so you didn't really think too much about it?
Didn't really spend that much time on it.
No, because we spotted the two missing members of the other party.
Yep.
And so then it was, oh, okay, job for the day's done, turn in.
I mean, we didn't really think of
setting up camp and getting food is you know, your priority.
It was just an odd light we saw, and that was the beginning and end of it.
And so then, was it a day or two that go by?
2 days.
2 days. So why don't you explain exactly what happened?
Well, the next day we went further up the lake system trying to get to Allegash Lake, but were unable to because of the volume of water flowing down from the lake. And so we camped alongside the shoreline north of Chamberlain Lake where the river flows in, and early the next morning went downstream to the portage area and portaged over onto Eagle Lake, which is where we ended up going to Smith Brook campsite, and we sat up camp there for the evening, and after we had our camp set up and our bags laid out, we stoked a fire up to last for a few hours to act as a beacon reference point for us to find our campsite, and we went out on the lake to fish. So we were out, took us maybe about 15-20 minutes minimum to work our way through the standing dead trees and other trees in the water, to go to an area where we figured had good fishing structure.
Yeah, we were on the southern end of Eagle Lake, which was pretty much a swamp-like area. There was a lot of old dead trees.
Like driftwood type
trees sticking out of the water or just underneath the water. And we thought, wow, this is a great place to go fishing.
Yeah, that's right. They like to hide in this stuff. Yeah.
So we weren't out there long. Once we were going across, and one of the guys on the other, Charlie was at one end of the canoe. One of the other guys, Chuck Rack, was at the other end of the canoe, and Jack and I were in the middle of the canoe. And all of a sudden, Chuck Rack said, "What the hell is that?" And I could see his face. I was facing him, just like I'm facing you, and I could see his face light up. And I thought, oh, no, the rangers. You know, we're out night fishing, and the rangers just got us. So I turned around to see where the light was coming from, and when I turned around, there was this huge light about 150, maybe 200 yards away from us, which was the end of the lake, bordered by tall pines. And just floating above these pines was this perfectly round, spherical, it was a whitish-yellow light.
So it was like a large ball?
It was like a large ball of light. And I noticed immediately that the quality of the light was exactly the same as I had noticed two nights previously when I was looking at this other light through the binoculars. Mm-hmm. I immediately recognized it as being the same. And it was a roiling kind of mist or almost like if you had a heavy fog or a heavy soup or a porridge that was roiling and boiling. That's the way it was. And it was a whitish yellow. It was very bright. And at times there would be a little bit more yellow in one area. Like at one point it would look like there was a vertical stripe down it.
And what about the movement of it?
It didn't move at all. It was just floating over the tops of the trees. You know, maybe 20, 30 feet over the tops of the trees. And you could see it illuminating the tops of the trees underneath and a slight reflection of it coming out over the edge of the lake water.
Mm-hmm.
So Charlie had the flashlight and he decided we'd signal it.
Oh.
And we said, oh, let's signal it.
Well, just
happens.
Out of curiosity, I mean, it was, it was only about a couple of hundred feet from where we were at this point. It had come up along the shoreline directly toward us, hovering about average 20 feet above the tops of the trees. And when it was directly across from us, I thought, what will it do if I shine a flashlight at it? And that being my major curiosity, after I flashed off a few bursts of light at it, it fired a beam of light from the bottom. Well, first of all, it stopped moving. It was moving about at a speed of a balloon moving through the air. But when I shined the light, it stopped abruptly. The shaft of light came right out from the bottom of this sphere, hit the water surface, and then that sphere of light followed this beam. As the beam was approaching us, we realized that the sphere was coming along too. Well, my curiosity at that point was satisfied, and so I replaced the flashlight with a canoe paddle, and assisted by the rest of the guys in the canoe, we started moving toward our fire as briskly as we could.
As fast as we could.
If we could have run, we would have.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
We were in the
flown,
water.
We
so.
Would have. Well, you know, one of the things we should mention, Martin, is when we first saw this thing. I mean, it was both terrifying and beautiful at the same time.
Wow.
I mean, it was just this beautiful light that was just, it was like it was alive. And we were sitting there trying to think of what this thing was because it made no noise at all. It was perfectly silent, absolutely, totally silent.
Wow.
And it was a still night. The water on the lake that night was like a sheet of glass. So there was no noise. And up there, there's no crickets or frogs. It's you hear an occasional loon, but other than that, it's totally silent.
Right. I remember going up in that area not quite so far as a young boy, and my ears ringing because it was so quiet.
Yeah, I mean, it's really quiet. Yeah. So, and this thing made no noise whatsoever. So, you know, we sat there for a few minutes. It was, you know, 5 or 10 minutes, I guess, trying to figure out what this thing was. First, we thought, well, okay, it's not a helicopter or an airplane, or we'd hear it.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't. I've seen pictures of weather balloons lots of times, and this thing didn't look anything like a weather balloon.
Well, it was nighttime, and it was illuminated.
Yeah,
especially
you know,
the beams
and
the beam
beams
down.
Don't shoot out of weather balloons. So when this thing shot that beam out, it was very scary. But I mean, I think we were very logical about thinking that you know whatever this thing is, it's our advantage to be dealing with it on solid ground rather than floating in the middle of a swamp.
Sure,
because we were seriously worried that if we tipped over or fell out of the canoe, we'd get snagged.
Someone was going to drown.
Somebody was going to drown.
Sure.
So we said, look, we're out of it. But I'll tell you, when we were paddling back to our campfire, we were paddling as fast as we possibly could.
Now, how many people were in the canoe? Was there four total?
Just the four of us, yeah.
So anyway, when we were paddling away from this thing as fast as we could, I remember Jack and I both kind of looked back because Charlie was paddling as fast as he could. Jack and I were using our hands.
Really?
Chuck Foltz was in the back, you know, steering us to our campsite. We could see the fire.
Yeah.
And then Jack and I both kind of looked back to see where this thing was because, you know, it was coming towards us when we left. And I remember looking back thinking it was still way back there. And then when I looked back, it was more like it was right behind us. And I remember thinking, there's no way that we're going to outrun this thing. And then our canoe just, you know, hit the beach and we went up onto the beach. And when we got out, we turned around and looked at this thing, and it was just right off the beach. I mean, I remember thinking that if I had a stone, I could bounce a stone off if I threw a stone hard enough.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a beam of light coming out of the bottom of it that was just shining straight down on the water. And
now, did it affect the water at all that you remember?
No.
Yeah. The water was as calm and as reflective as a sheet of glass.
Yeah.
There was no moon in the night sky. All of the stars were reflected in the water.
Yeah.
So now that we're on shore, I pick up the flashlight again and I signal it. But at the time I signaled it, once we were on the shore, it began to move directly away from us. I, for some reason, felt it was about to go at a quick rate of speed, so I took the flashlight and shined it at my wristwatch, trying to find the sweep hand. And while that just took a moment or two, I looked back up, reacquired the sphere, and it just sort of like skipped out. Jim and everybody observed it sort of like here, there, like going up steps, so to speak.
Yeah, I remembered when we were staying or watching it, it winked out the same way it did the two nights prior from the outside edge in.
Yep.
And then a second later, the light came on again. And I think
at
one time the beam had gone
away.
Up.
A headlight.
You could see a beam going up ahead of it. And then this thing would wink out, and then a second later it would come on again, only it would be much further away and higher. And then it would wink out again, and then a second later it would come on again, and then it would be much further away and higher. So
very
you had
sporadic.
This visual.
At one point it just sort of
eventually
went straight out as a pinpoint, as a ball of light, and then it disappeared as a pinpoint of light in the night sky. That's when I took and swung the flashlight back on the wristwatch, and this whole movement only took 8 to 10 seconds from the time it began to move away until it was indistinguishable in the night sky.
Yep. And it still made
no noise,
none at all. And this thing was clearly going much faster than the speed of sound. There was no sonic signature.
Yeah, that's always bizarre, isn't it? So now you notice the fire has changed.
Well, not at first. I mean, we just sort of all walked back up to the campsite and just dropped, just sheer exhaustion. We figured from our exertion paddling away. And it was at that point that I walked over to the campfire because I had been focused on the flames as I was paddling to our campsite.
Sure.
And it just seemed like a moment later we were on the shore, and now the fire is burned out. And if you've ever built any fire, you know it burns until it extinguishes itself or you put it out. So we didn't really think that what happened to all the flames. This thing was just burning a few moments ago, and now it's out.
Yeah, we didn't even think about it.
So you swept the flashlight by your wristwatch. Did you notice the time?
Yeah, yeah. It was little after 10 in the evening, and we had gone out onto the water just a little after 7 in the evening. But we didn't think anything about 3 hours have just passed. Because as far as we were concerned, or we knew, we had only gone out under the water, began fishing, saw this thing, had our brief encounter, and made it back to shore as quickly as we could, and then it disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
And for, you know,
years, we never thought about it. We didn't have any concept of missing time in those days.
Did you talk a lot about between among yourselves, the four of you, about this situation, or did it just
not
kind of fade
evening.
Out?
Not that evening. We came
no,
out. The next
no,
morning, we,
the next
that's
morning.
All we could talk about
yeah.
was what the heck was did we just see last night. But we still didn't make, we still didn't have any connection at all about the fire. It was just something that never, it was almost as, I mean, in hindsight, it was almost as if we were programmed not to think about it.
Yeah.
But,
just,
yeah, but in a way, you know, I mean, you're up there out in the boonies in the middle of the night. You are active from daylight until dusk, and then you go to sleep. There's no news programs, no sports games you're wanting to see or anything because you don't have anything.
Yeah, no outside stimuli.
No, yeah. Nothing at all.
Yeah, but, you know, even like that, I mean, you would think that since he looked at his watch, he'd say, oh, my God, it's past 10 o'clock. What happened? We just,
yeah.
you know, we've been out here for a long time. He never even thought of that.
Yeah.
No.
It could possibly have been something that was changed
yeah.
in your thinking.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely yeah. programmed not to even think about it.
Yeah.
And we didn't for years.
So I mean, let's talk about years. So years go by, and what happens?
Well, 2 years after we came back from the Allegash, I had a bad accident in Calais, Maine. I walked into a closet in a house that didn't have a floor in it. And I fell 14 feet into the basement.
Oh, my God.
And broke my back in a number of places. And I also rammed my spinal cord up into my brain and suffered some serious brain damage. It took me a long time to come back from. And so for years, I was recuperating from this accident. It was basically all I did. And the accident, in addition to the bad back, it left me with epilepsy. I developed temporolimbic epilepsy, which would the seizures would manifest themselves. I always felt like I was having a heart attack. Like, you know, my breathing would become erratic. My heartbeat would become erratic. I'd get chest pains and pains in my left side. So I was always going into the hospital thinking I was having some kind of heart attack. And it took years for them to diagnose it. I mean, the seizures started in 1979, about a year after the accident, and I wasn't diagnosed with the temporolimbic epilepsy till 1983. Mm. So there was a time period where I was having these episodes of, you know, something was happening, thinking I was having heart attacks. And every time I'd go to the emergency room somewhere, they'd say, well, you're not having a heart attack. We don't know what's wrong with you. And it took them a long time to finally do the testing and diagnose it as temporolimbic. And one of the problems that was associated with the seizure condition was during that same time I was developing these horrible nightmares. I would go to bed at night and I'd wake up in the middle of the night thinking that there was somebody in my room and they would be trying pulling at me in the bed, and I always felt terrified and felt like there was something malevolent in the room with me. Mm-hmm. And it got so bad that I would go around the house before I'd go to sleep at night, and I'd make sure, whether it was winter, summer, spring, fall, it didn't matter to me, I made sure every window in the house was closed and locked, and I was even padlocking myself in the bedroom because part of me thought that maybe one of my roommates was coming into my room while I was sleeping for what reason, I have no idea. And so I was getting really paranoid, and I wasn't sleeping. I was terrified to go to sleep. And so because of the sleep deprivation, my seizure activity was going through the roof. And I wound up being admitted into the hospital for treatment because of the sleep deprivation and the increase in seizures. This was around 1988. And 87, 88. And so while I was in the hospital at one point, they were doing long-term EEG tests, electroencephalograms. And so I was bedridden with all these electrodes connected to my head, and I was bored stiff because all I could do was stare at the ceiling. And I had asked one of the nurses to if she could give me something to read. Well, she went out into the lobby and came back with Whitley Strieber's Communion.
Wow.
And when I saw the face on there, I didn't know who he was, or, you know, I had no idea what this book was about. I just saw this bizarre face on it and went into a fit. I just freaked out. And so a couple hours later, one of the psychiatrists that is in the neural clinic team at the hospital came in and said, Jim, what's going on here? You know, I mean, why did you just have this near fit? And I said, well, I just didn't like that book. I'm hooked up to this stuff. I'm not in a very good mood. You know, what do you want? And so he said, well, come on, something's going on. I said, well, it reminds me of these nightmares I'm having. And so he said, well, you know, can you talk about your nightmares? These nightmares are keeping you up at night. This is an issue we have to deal with. And so I started talking about these nightmares of waking up at night and having feeling like there was or seeing movement in my room and feeling that I was being violated in some way. And he came back a few days later and he said, well, you know, I've recently had dinner with a friend of mine who turned out to be Dr. John Mack from Harvard.
Wow. Oh, coincidences. Yeah.
He said, Dr. Mack happens to be working with some people who are having nightmares very similar to what you're describing. And I want to ask you an odd question. I want you to be honest with me. And I said, well, of course, just ask me whatever you want. He said, have you ever seen a UFO or been close to a UFO? And I said, you know, yeah, as a matter of fact, I have. But what does that have to do with my seizure disorder? You know, I don't want to talk about UFOs. I can tell you all about this UFO we saw up in Maine 2 years ago, but I don't see what that has to do with my seizures. And so I was very reluctant to talk with him about this. But eventually he said, look, you know, I think there's a connection here somehow, and I want you to talk to someone in the field, in the UFO field. And he was the person who contacted Raymond E. Fowler, who at that time, I believe, was Northeastern head of investigations for MUFON, or he's one of the head of the investigations for MUFON at the time, the Mutual UFO Network. And he arranged to have me meet Ray. Ray was coming in a couple of weeks to one of the local conventions. And so I went and met and talked to Ray, and Ray asked me to describe our encounter in Maine, which up to that time was, you know, all we remembered was a sighting being chased across this lake at night by this object. And during the course of the conversation, I had mentioned that Charlie was with me and this other guy and my twin brother Jack. And when I said twin brother Jack, he said, "Wait a minute, did you just say twin?" And I said, "Yeah, I have an identical twin." So then that seemed to pique his interest a little bit more. And at that time, he had a table set up where he was selling some of his previous books. So he shut down the table and said, "Okay, I want you to go through this whole thing from beginning to end, this sighting you had in Maine." And so I did. I went through it again. And then at the end of the end of the second run through, he asked me if I and the other guys would be willing to fill out a MUFON report. So I said, "Well, I will certainly do it, and let me talk to the other guys." And I contact Chuck and my brother and the other guy, and we all agreed to fill out a report. And so once we did that, then Ray asked if he could continue a more in-depth investigation. You want to go through that part, Charlie?
After he received the MUFON contact forms, he became quite interested in, and then we had provided a list of people that we had originally, back in 1976, shared our story of being chased across the lake from. That was one of his starting points. And then from there, he went on and checked the Bureau, I think it's somewhere in New York State, where all the weather reports and records are stored for the weather patterns across the U.S. And all the records are compiled and stored in an archive. Well, he checked those and found that there was no moon and that the weather was as we had described it. And we had in our reports mentioned a ranger named Everett E. Cram, who was the check-in ranger that we had met when we began our canoe trip on the Allegash system. And so Ray then progressed further for probably it was over almost a year and a half minimum before he was done investigating the background on us. And after doing such extensive research, he then made arrangements with a hypnotherapist named Tony Constantino and then brought us in individually one by one. We each then went through regression. I think, Jim, you were the first one to go, yeah. And then Jack,
yep.
And then me,
and then Chuck.
And
in fact, we went through multiple regressions.
We also went through some polygraph testing.
That came later that on,
was,
though.
Yeah, but Ernie Rice was the polygraph expert. He used to be a polygraph technician for the Secret Service, and he was currently doing a lot of work with the Massachusetts State Police Department in the state of Massachusetts.
Yeah, he was definitely qualified. One of the things I should mention, Martin, is the day after we had this chase event on the Allegash, we actually reported it to one of the rangers that was up on the lake system. They had a huge ranger station up on the lakes. There was a ranger center there. And every day the rangers come to the campers' campsites to collect your trash so the bears don't come into your campsites. And so the morning after we had this encounter, one of the rangers came to collect our trash. In fact, we waved them over. And we actually made a formal report to the ranger.
Hmm.
And Ray was able to get that report.
Oh, that's nice.
When he started doing his investigations.
Now, can you tell, when you started doing this regression, can you give the details of what came out of it?
Yeah, I went first. And to be honest with you, I didn't really think much of hypnosis at the time. I didn't, you know, I was totally naive about what hypnosis really was. I'd never been hypnotized in my life, and I always thought it was a carnival act.
Right.
You know, you went to some, they made you cluck like a chicken and quack like a duck. And it wasn't anything like that. It was basically just a very intense state of relaxation where you could focus on an event and without distraction, so you could better remember, you know, what happened at the time. So what Tony Constantino did was he put me in a very relaxed state and started us and took us back to that night on the Allegas so we could try and see if we could remember anything more about it. Excuse me. And I did remember a lot more. I remember that when we were paddling back to the campfire, and right after Jack and I had looked back to see where this thing was, at first it was right behind us, and then I looked again, and it was literally right on top of us. And then all of a sudden, this tube of light came out of this thing, and it wasn't a solid beam of light. It was like a straw or a glass
made of glass.
Yeah, and it was. If you could imagine the
big
the
enough
wall,
to take in a Volkswagen.
The wall of it was good 10 feet in diameter, I'd say 8-10 feet in diameter. And if you can imagine the wall of the straw had this weird bluish whitish light that scintillated. It reminded me of like when you're in a dusty room with sunlight coming through a window, and you can see the dust kind of flowing,
dust particles
like
flicking.
Smoke, you know, through the shafts of light. Mm-hmm. That's the way this energy seemed to move. But the inside of it was dark. It was like it was much darker. It wasn't black, but it was dark.
Wow.
And I remembered looking up this beam, and the craft was like right on top. It was right above us. I remember looking straight up. And at the top of it, it was black underneath. And I remember thinking, oh, my God, what is this? And then all of a sudden, I looked back down, and I was facing Chuck Rack, and he was gone. And I was like, oh, my God, what happened to Chuck? What happened to Chuck? I thought he fell in the water or something. And then all of a sudden, I felt as if every molecule in my body was about ready to explode. I didn't feel any kind of heat or any kind of pain, but it was more like a pressure or feeling that there was some kind of energy happening, not just on the surface of my body, but inside every molecule. Wow. And then the next thing I remembered was sitting in a room somewhere with my peripheral vision was all blurred, and I could focus pretty clearly directly in front of me. If I was looking directly at you, Martin, you were in focus, but everything around you was this kind of foggy, as if, you know, there was a fog all around it. And I remembered I was sitting, and I was looking out, and I could see my brother Jack standing up like maybe 10 feet away in front of me in this room, and he didn't have any clothes on. He was totally naked. And there was these two figures, or I think it was one figure at first, and then another one came a little after. But at first I noticed there was a figure that was facing him, and it was taking his arms, and it was articulating his wrists and moving his arm around as if it was inspecting his joints and things. And I remember thinking to myself, God, he's going to break Jack's arm if he keeps doing that. But for some reason at first I couldn't see the face. Every time Tony Constantino would ask me what the figure looked like, they'd say, well, can you see the face? And I go, no, I can't make out the face. I can't make out the face. Because I was so focused on what they were doing to Jack, I thought for sure they were going to, like, you know, totally dislocate his arm. And then I was able to focus, and I remember, like, I just totally flipped because this thing had a face like a head, like a bug, like an insect. Wow. I remember saying to Ray, it looks like a bug. It looks like a bug. I was completely freaking out. And it had this weird kind of wand, like a thin needle-like wand in its hand that was maybe 12 or 14 inches long, and it had just a tiny little bulb on it, and it was scanning Jack. Like it was scanning his chest, and it would touch him on certain parts, you know, on different parts of his body. And at that point, I just went into hysterics. I mean, I couldn't believe what I was seeing. This thing was clearly not human.
Wow.
It had an insect-like head. That's what it looked like. It had these big eyes, like a bug eyes, like an ant has.
Have you ever tried to draw, or has a rendition of this been drawn?
Oh yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
It's probably available online.
It is, yep.
Yeah.
It's public domain, and it's also in Ray's book that he wrote about the case later on.
Mm-hmm.
We all did drawings. I mean, one of the things that Ray asked us to do, because we were all artists at the time, he asked if, you know, if I could make a drawing of it, would I do that? And I said, sure. And I'm not a very good drawer. Like Charlie and Jack are amazing illustrators. At that time, I was working in clay. I was a potter,
yep.
So I was very good with clay forms and things. But yep. I'm by no means even a good drawer. I'm terrible. I can do little simple line drawings with a little shading. That's about as good as my drawings get. But I did a pretty good rendition of what I remembered seeing. And
Chuck's laughing.
Well, I just thought he draws bugs. But as long as they're ET type bugs.
Yeah.
Okay. So,
but anyway, I remembered sitting, and then I noticed that Charlie was sitting on this. I realized I was sitting on a bench that was sticking out of the wall wherever we were. I had no idea where we were. But Charlie was sitting next to me, and Chuck Rack was sitting on this same bench. We were all naked. Mm. None of us had any clothes on. And I remember thinking to myself, like, what is happening? What is going on? I was in a total state of terror. I can't describe what it felt like to be in that kind of a state of terror. I've never been that terrified in my life ever.
Absolutely, I'm
and
sure.
It was totally consuming. I mean, as soon as I was able to see the heads and realize that whatever these things were, they weren't human. I just flipped, and so then I was watching what they were doing to Jack, and then a second being came, and they walked Jack through this opening. It was like a hallway or a door of some sort, and then they came for me, and they took me. They two of them came, one on either side, and they took me by my arms. They lifted me up, and they started walking me towards this same area where they had walked Jack, and he disappeared somewhere, and I didn't want to go. I was like terrified, and so I balked. I actually tried to resist. And one of them took one of these wands and they stuck it up into my rib cage, and it was really painful.
And they just poked you in the ribs.
Yeah, they poked me.
Wow.
You know, like a prod. They prodded me like a cattle prod,
mm-hmm.
And it hurt a lot. And I remember I didn't hear anything in my head. I didn't hear a voice, but I got a clear mental message or an impression that I must cooperate.
Yep.
I will cooperate. And if I don't cooperate, bad things are going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So at that point, I was in a total state of terror, but at that point, the thought came to my head that, whoa, these things are not friendly. You know, these things could be malevolent. And then that made me even more terrified. So I went. I thought, okay, I'm going to bide my time. And when I get an opportunity to escape, if I ever get an opportunity, I'm going to take it. So they took me through this room. And then I remembered, I mean, you have to understand, like, all these memories come through in patches. In pieces. It's not like you remember everything from point A to point B from beginning to end in continuity. It's like you seem to remember part of an event, little snippets, and then you suddenly remember being somewhere else. So I remember them walking into this hallway. It was like a hallway of some sort. And then the next memory I had was being on a table, like an examination table. And there was more of them. There was one on either side of me, and there was another one on the base.
They all looked the same, basically?
They all looked the same. They weren't that small. They weren't like the little tiny grays. They were almost our size. My impression was that they were almost as tall as I was. And they had a face that looked like an insect, or at least they had these big eyes. They could have been goggles or with some kind of mask, because it looked like they had a projection coming out where our mouths usually are,
yep,
which could have been some type of mask. I don't know. They didn't seem to have any ears that I noticed. They had really thin necks, like almost pencil-thin like necks. They had four fingers that were...
an articulating joint, yeah, where would be...
There was
like
a fold.
Palm of her hand.
There was a fold down the center of their hand, so they could fold the two fingers opposite one another.
Instead of having thumbs.
They had four opposable digits, as we only have our thumbs.
Opposing. And they wore some type of clothing. I remembered it was like it reminded me of like the skin tight spandex that skiers wear.
Yeah, that's kind of what you hear a lot.
Yeah, that's what it reminded.
Like full body.
Coverall.
It was full body.
Yeah. Coverall, yeah,
I meant. Full body. And I remembered that. And anyway, they had me on this table, and they came with this device which looked like a some kind of tube. I mean, it's hard to describe. I mean, everything that I saw, I've never seen before. So it was
alien.
Yeah, it was alien. And I got this clear impression. I mean, the communication for me was never things like words in my head or a voice. It was like I telepathically knew what they wanted me to do.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only way I can describe it. But it was clear. I mean, it wasn't like I had to guess.
Yeah.
I mean, I knew what they wanted, and I knew that they wanted a sperm sample. And so, like, I'm thinking, oh my God, how am I going to do this? I mean, I'm terrified. You know, my thing was like, you know, it was like somewhere inside of me. That's how scared I was. So, mm-hmm. I started. So then, all these thoughts of like having sexual relations with my girlfriend, or, you know, women magazines, I don't know, but all these sexual images started floating through my head, and eventually they got a sperm sample out of me. And then I remembered, I felt really violated. I felt like, wow, I've just been raped here. And I was really angry, and I was really scared, and I thought, you know, I could break one of their necks. If I grab them.
Pencil thin neck.
Maybe I could like break one and then create a diversion and try to get out of there, because I was absolutely certain in my mind that the next thing they were going to do was start cutting me open. You know, it was dissection time coming real soon. And I didn't want to go there.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, it sounds horrible that I would even think of, you know, killing something, but I was, to me, it was
life.
My life.
Yeah,
it's pretty much all I remember, because I was so upset that Ray and Tony thought I was going to have a seizure, and so they quickly brought me out. So
yeah,
every time they would take me in, I would go into these intense anxiety states,
yeah,
and then they'd have to bring me out again. And they actually got a lot more information from Charlie and Jack than they did from me. So
right.
Charlie should at least...
Yeah, Charlie, so I'm going to ask you if your regression had very similar... Was it basically similar? And did it fit everybody else as well? Did everyone else...
It did, and in much the same as if you were in an automobile with, let's say, four people. I use this example. And you have an automobile accident. All four people remember the accident. All four people remember the details. But if you're behind the driving wheel, you're going to have a point of view and remember details that the people in the back seat are not going to have, because they're looking elsewhere at things that you didn't see. So I very much remember the exam room as being very brightly illuminated, but my field of vision was quite short and shallow. I have had kind of a similar thing when I've gone to the eye doctors and my eyes were dilated.
Yes.
But only a bit more intense than that. But it was a very unnerving experience. And the only positive thing I can say is, hey, it was catch and release.
Yeah, just like you were doing up in Maine, right? Now, would you describe the beings exactly like Jim does?
Slightly different, but very much the same.
What was that when you were regressing? Do you remember the shock of seeing them for the first time like he was talking
about? Oh, hell yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you never forget that.
I bet.
My first memory of the regression, struggling to lift my head up. And as I lifted my head up, I realized I was on some type of flat surface. It felt like kind of like leather in a way, like a soft leather, but it was a firm surface. And the first thing that I focused on were my feet. And I was thinking, that's odd. Where the hell are my socks? And then I thought, well, where are my shoes? And then I realized I didn't have any clothing on, and that was my next question. I said, where the hell are my clothes? And the last one was, where the hell am I? I could just barely make out some figure standing in front of me, but I could like kind of see the twins and Chuck sitting on this bench, and I was screaming in my head. I couldn't articulate anything. Help me. What are you guys just sitting there for? I wasn't restrained. I had no restraints upon me that I could see at all. And as I was fighting to lift myself up and help myself out of this situation, unseen until that instant, there was one of these beings standing right at my head, and it bent forward and made eye contact with me, at which point the only thing I could move was my head, and I tried to move it as far away from this thing as I could, which was just down to the surface of this table I was on, which was only a couple of inches. But when my eyes made eye contact, I had this sensation, a very physical sensation, of my mind like rushing up to merge with this individual's conscious or something, much like being on a roller coaster and doing the first deep drop and you feel your stomach coming up. Well, I had this physical sensation of my mind dropping up into this being's mind. And I was told to comply and follow instruction, and I would be not harmed.
Thing that comes to mind, if Jim didn't have this accident and then the epilepsy and start having these dreams, do you think this would have eventually surfaced?
I do, because one thing that was happening simultaneously, and this is something that is, one thing that, to finish this, you're responding to your question, yes, I feel that it would, because at the same time Jim was experiencing his nightmares, which were basically flashbacks of this experience in on the Allagash. His twin brother, Jack, was having nightmares at the very same time in Vermont. But Jack could confide in his wife, Mary, where Jim is at this point in time very closed-mouthed and internalized everything much more than he does today. So I do believe that, it would eventually have come out. One unique thing that used to happen with the three of us in particular, it was kind of uncannily freakish, where I would walk to my phone because I was thinking about calling either Jack or Jim, and I would pick up the phone and I would go to dial and somebody would be on the phone and it would be one of them. And the same thing would happen. They would think of calling me, and they picked up the phone, and I was already on the line. And that happened for years and years.
Wow. And you hear about things like this, you know, people getting a little telepathy out of, you know, situations. Yeah. I mean, that's one thing you do hear quite often.
Our prescience is another one. People seem to be able to predict future events.
Yeah,
but there's definitely some kind of psychic change in the individuals. I mean, other things that happened to us was our artwork changed drastically.
Wow.
After the Allagash event, Jack and mine's and Charlie's completely changed from what we were doing before. In Jack and mine's case, we also developed these intense, obsessive, compulsive behaviors where, in Jack's case, he became obsessive about
mathematics,
different kinds of mathematics, particularly geometries.
Wow.
And I became compulsive about ancient temples being a form of macrochip technology somehow. And I truly believe that.
Wow.
And I just knew that somehow that there was a connection.
One of the things about Jack with his consuming interest in mathematics and the way his artwork had changed, his occupation went and changed. He ended up going into the space industry, believe it or not.
Amazing. Well, we're out of time. Thank you both so much. And
thank you, Martin.
We could definitely keep talking about this because it seems
like
there's a lot more to talk about. Yeah. But anyway, it's been a real pleasure meeting you both.
Well, thank you for having us.
Thank you, Martin.
You bet.
It's been a pleasure.